lecture on violence by Dr. Jolyon West. Now, Dr. West is a medical man, a psychiatrist, a graduate of the University of Minnesota, and the product of many other institutions of considerable repute. He has been a chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Oklahoma Medical School, becoming that back in 1954. In 1969, he moved to the University of California at Los Angeles and became a professor there and head, at least chairman, I think they call it there, of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. He still occupies that position. He's a scholar of renown, having published several works of considerable distinction. But he's not a mere academician. He has been called on to play an active part in many organizations, from service on hospital staffs to advising government agencies, both national and international. As a lawyer, I note that he has been called on also by courts to give expert advice on matters before the courts, and some of these cases have been rather celebrated. I think then that we are fortunate indeed to have someone of his learning and reputation to speak to us this evening, and it gives me very great pleasure now to call on him to speak to us on the subject of violence.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen. I feel some diffidence in coming to Canada to talk on the subject of violence, knowing that in contrast with the United States, you have so little of it here. Nevertheless, in case the infection should cross the border, perhaps it might be well for you to understand that your nation is adjacent to one which is experiencing an epidemic. It is about that epidemic of violence that I intend to talk this evening, but it might be best if I began by making it clear what I'm not going to talk about. In fact, I'm not going to talk about most of the violence that bedevils our poor, unfortunate, and long-suffering planet. So far in the 20th century, in its first four-fifths, more than 120 million people have died at the hands of their fellows. A veritable nation of the dead, who have been the victims of a type of violence that I call collective violence. This type of violence involves groups of people who attack other groups of people and who injure or destroy them, not because of who they are as individuals, but because of what they are as members of their groups. Wars, revolutions, riots, pogroms, religious conflict, tribal strife on every continent It has been with us since before recorded history and continues unabated at this moment. It might be worth taking a few minutes to make it clear that my view of collective violence differs significantly from that of many of the putative authorities in this field. In fact, I began my studies of violence with an interest in the collective variety. Having served in a couple of wars, I felt that I had a pretty good introduction to the topic. And since I'm not going to talk about it tonight, I will just mention en passant that the most fashionable contemporary theory of collective violence is wrong. This is the theory put forward by some prominent ethologists, including the Nobel Prize winner Konrad Lorenz, who probably knows more about geese than any person alive, and perhaps popularized mostly by a very fine writer named Robert Ardrey in a book called The Territorial Imperative. This theory of collective violence holds that man is a creature of his instincts, no less than other creatures, that the territorial imperative rules us as it does them, and that in its grip we band together and attack each other because of the nature of our attachment to our territory. Now, even Mr. Ardrey mentions very quickly in a sentence or two early in his book that not all animals are territorial. And he just happens to mention a few that are most like us, with the largest brains, with the most highly developed intelligence, with the greatest capacity for movement, the cetacea, the great seagoing mammals, including the dolphins and whales, the gorilla, who is so much like man that he has very similar blood types, the elephant, with a very large brain indeed, and a life span very much like our own. These animals, he mentions, are not territorial, and then goes on to describe in exquisite detail for some pages the territorial behavior of the wasp, not to mention the wolf and any variety of antelope. We are really more like the gorillas than we are like the wasps. Man is not really a territorial animal. And there is a great deal of evidence deriving from the study of man that supports this other view. We are governed by imperatives. I call them biosocial imperatives that have a great deal to do with collective violence. But since I'm not going to talk about this tonight, I want to let you know that it's a problem that has plagued man for as long as, at least, as there have been philosophers. And after some years of studying it, I figured it out. You can imagine how good that made me feel, especially when I mobilized my energy sufficient to publish my findings. Please come in and sit down. It won't bother me a bit. My students are always wandering in and out. And there are lots of seats, including some down here in front. After I published my insight and to the nature of collective violence. Of course, it was my hope that this would be of great subsequent benefit to the humankind. I waited for the crowned heads, the beribboned generals, the political leaders, the heads of government, of state, to beat a pathway to my door, or at least to call. Nobody called. It was very discouraging. It made me think that perhaps people like Idi Amin or Colonel Gaddafi were not reading the archives of general psychiatry. And that's a frightening thought. While I was waiting to hear, I became aware of some other noise in the system. At that time, I was still at the University of Oklahoma, and as so often the case in general hospitals, psychiatry is usually put off to one side and preferably all the way up on the top, as far away from everyone as possible. I believe that the people who design hospitals still suspect that mental illness may be contagious. So there I was up on the top floor of the east wing of the university hospital, right up at the head of the elevator shaft. And I became aware of these sounds coming up the elevator shaft from the emergency room, which is always at the bottom of the elevator shaft. Groans and weeping and the outcry of people who had been stabbed or chopped or shot, or whose loved ones had just died in their own blood in the ambulance on the way to the emergency room. And I thought perhaps, short of solving the problems of the world through my comprehension of collective violence and all of the soldiers I've studied and all of the racial strife that I had analyzed, that I perhaps should start to look at this other kind. Interpersonal violence is quite another kind. And after 30 years of studying violence, I'm here to tell you that anyone who offers you a universal theory of violence that is intended at this stage of our knowledge to accomplish it all is making a mistake. Interpersonal violence is very different to collective violence, and generally it's carried out by different kinds of people for very different reasons and under totally different circumstances. In fact, if you're interested, as I once was, in killing large numbers of people, and look around for the organization that will permit you to do it, like the army in time of a war. And you don't want to be a piker, which I have to admit that I was when I first enlisted. A piker in the sense that I really only wanted to kill them one at a time, and I wanted to do it in a personal way. I wanted to watch them die. I was a bloodthirsty young fella in 1942. But nowadays, and even then, there were much more efficient ways of engaging in the collective violence if you didn't take it personally, as we Jews tended to do at that time. You could drop bombs and blow up dozens, scores, hundreds, or even thousands of people. You could even shoot artillery shells at them from some distance away. And today, if you were on a bomber crew or a nuclear submarine with thermonuclear weapons aboard, just think of all the people you might be able to destroy if the time came that you were supposed to do it. Now, who are these individuals who are entitled to carry out such acts, whether it's as many as I might have been able to kill with my machine gun, or larger numbers with artillery shells or with bombs or subsequently rockets and so on. All their healthy, relatively young men, carefully screened for both physical and mental defects, and if they have any significant defects, they're ruled out. During World War II, a third of those who were ruled out were eliminated from military service primarily for mental reasons. And today, those standards are higher than ever. If you wanted to serve in a modern bomber crew, you wouldn't be allowed even to become a candidate if you were the least troubled emotionally. And there's one thing that would absolutely rule you out from the beginning, and that is any history of violent behavior whatsoever. Violent people are not wanted to undertake enterprises like this. People who can't keep their temper, people who have hurt other people. The folks who are wanted are calm, good-natured, have good relationships with others, team players, preferably religious, preferably family men, preferably those with good values, intelligent, stable, mature, and fundamentally nonviolent. These are the people who are in the position to exercise the most violence. And those who were involved in the violence in my emergency room turned out to be quite a different lot from that. And it's about that lot I intend to speak for the rest of the evening. Now, what do I mean by violence and the perpetrators and victims thereof? I mean life-threatening behavior. I mean actions that injure or kill. And I include not only such actions directed against another person, but those directed against the self as well. It's no longer possible to differentiate self-destructiveness from destructiveness toward others. The two are very closely linked. Carl Menninger once said that every suicide is half a murder. What he meant by that is that individuals can become so enraged with other people that they are able to kill, but not to turn it outward. They turn it against themselves. And that's the suicidal act. But what he didn't tell us was that many murderers are basically self-destructive people, and that the act of homicide may very well be a suicidal act as well, or even primarily so. It's true, I've seen many such cases now. I've been collecting them. How do you know it? Well, you use modern methods now, case studies, epidemiological techniques, cross-cultural investigations, international large-scale statistics. There are many ways of getting at this. Between 10 and 20% of all the calls to the Los Angeles Suicide Prevention Center are really homicide prevention calls. People call and say, I know I'm going to kill somebody. I don't know who else to call. Sometimes they say, I think I'm going to kill myself or somebody else, and they don't know which. But it remained for D.J. West, no relation, although I'd be proud to claim him, to do the definitive study in Great Britain. After the death penalty was abolished, he decided to try to ascertain what became of all the murderers. These were the real murderers, convicted. He found out that two-thirds of all these murderers, at some time subsequent to the homicide for which they were convicted made serious suicidal attempts, and of those, eventually, half succeeded. Which is to say that over the course of a whole generation of follow-up, one-third of all murderers in Great Britain ended up killing themselves. And when I thought that that was an astonishing figure, we don't have any hope in the United States of such follow-up studies, that means just are not available yet, I looked to find a control country and picked Denmark, which has very good statistics and had abolished the death penalty too. And in Denmark, it was 40% of all murderers end up committing suicide. So the connection between suicide and homicide is exceedingly close. And it also accounts for another very interesting phenomenon that has some topical interest, and one which served, in a way, as my own introduction to interpersonal violence, and that's the death penalty. Do you have the death penalty here?
No.
Such a civilized place. It's coming back in the United States by popular demand. And you may see it too. I mean the popular demand. Now, I'm sure, since you don't have the death penalty here, that none of you very nice people ever took part in an execution. But I did. And furthermore, I did it without a qualm. It was a hanging, not a lynching. It was legal. It was in a nice little town in Iowa, my wife's hometown. In 1952, there were still hanging people there. I was passing through town, and the family doctor, who was an old friend, asked me if I would help him out, because there was an execution the next morning, and his regular partner had gone fishing. And law required two physicians to be present to certify the fact and moment of death. And had I ever witnessed an execution? I said I hadn't. Well, he needed the help, and it should be interesting, so I said I'd be glad to help out. It wasn't as though, I was then a physician, I was back in the service again. I'd seen plenty of people die. I didn't even know what this chap was being executed for, except that it was undoubtedly murder, which it was. Well, during the 12 and a half minutes that it took him to stop breathing at the end of the rope, or to stop for his heart to stop beating, I had ample opportunity to wonder why it was that this had never come up in my experience before, and to look at the faces of the people in the gallery and wonder exactly what brought them there. So after I left, the first chance I got, I looked up the situation in my own home state, which was Wisconsin, and in Minnesota, where I had my medical education, both states bordering on Iowa and very much like Iowa in most every other respect, except that neither Wisconsin nor Minnesota had had the death penalty since before the Civil War. Over 100 years without it. So I looked up the murder rates, and lo and behold, in Minnesota and Wisconsin, with no death penalty, the murder rates were lower than they were in Iowa. And I wondered why that might be. Since then, other studies have been done to show that the death penalty unquestionably induces more murders than it deters. And the people who represent that small margin of difference are all very much like some of the people that I have examined myself through the years, or about whom I have obtained the essential information. These are people who commit homicide in order to get themselves executed. They do it sometimes even though the victim is a stranger. They will go from one place to another. They'll leave a state that doesn't have a death penalty, go to one that does, there murder almost at random, and demand to be executed and get it, which you might say is no great loss for society, but doesn't help the people in those states who got killed out of somebody's pathological desire to die at the hands of the state. So much for the putative protections offered by the death penalty. You don't have it. If I were you, I'd keep it out. Any people like that here, well, have to go to Texas or somewhere where the climate is more favorable and commit their murders there. Having said this about suicide and homicide and the way that they're all linked up together, it doesn't mean that you can't study them separately for statistical reasons. You can lump all the violence together, you can separate it out into its components, and that's the way modern research on interpersonal violence has to be done. I'll show you a few things that turn up in this type of research. Which is, and this offering this evening is by no means intended to be a comprehensive treatment of the topic. Now let's see here. This turns it on. This turns down the lights. I don't want to make it too dark to tempt the sleep deprived. Now here are a couple of English-speaking countries that have very stable homicide rates over a period of 20 years. That slide doesn't take it up quite to the present, but it hasn't changed significantly. And you'll see that New Zealand is less violent than Australia as far as homicide goes, and it's continued that way right along. Now, if you look at the suicide rates in the same two countries over the same period of time, something rather different appears. Australia appears to have had an epidemic of suicides. New Zealand didn't. In fact, in the 2 months I spent trying to figure out what was responsible for this while I was down in both countries, I heard all kinds of explanations. The one I liked the best was the one in which when people in New Zealand get depressed, they go to Australia and kill themselves. But that wasn't it, because they're very proud people down there, and if that had happened, he would still count for the New Zealand side. If later on, if we have time for some questions and anyone's interested in that particular epidemic, I'll tell you more about it. But the point is that it's possible by studying trends through time to pick up clues about violence. It's also possible to look at different countries and ask yourselves how they differ. Now, if you look at the suicide rates in the five countries I picked there, you'll see that the United States is about average. England and Italy have suicide rates significantly lower, that's in 75. Japan and Sweden, suicide rates significantly higher than the US. But if you look at the homicide rates, it's 1,000% higher in the US than it is in any of those other countries. Trends through time may be instructive in other respects. Now, the suicide rate in the UK has fallen steadily for the last 20 years, and it's risen steadily in Canada. It's gone up from the figure you see there. The suicide rate in Canada, the last I was able to find, was 14. It's higher than it is in the U.S. now. And that was in 1980, and it's higher than that now, and it's highest of all here. This is the most suicidal community in Canada. I don't want you to feel sensitive about that, because the same trend obtains in the U.S. The suicide rates are higher in the West Coast cities. Seattle and San Francisco have the highest suicide rates. The beautiful countries on the west, the beautiful cities and communities on the western shore. Why should that be? It's another one of those questions that for which there may be answers, but the questions can be asked only when one begins to look at the data. If you look at all kinds of violence in the U.S., it's going up. And all of that represents perpetrators and victims. If you take murder, homicide, you can see how fast it's going up in the United States. It's increasing faster in some states than in others. Different types of violence are going up at slightly different rates. But this is the percent increase through time. The bottom curve there, number one, is the population growth. And everything else is the violence growth. Again, broken down by cities, of all types of violent crime, by states. I don't really want to get into all of this. Homicide alone. You make interesting observations. For example, New York State and New York City have higher rates of violence than California or Los Angeles. New York beats us out when it comes to violent crime. But when it comes to murder, aha, there Los Angeles surpasses New York significantly. Why should that be? My hometown is Madison, Wisconsin. Nice little town. The other big city in Wisconsin is Milwaukee. The rate of armed robbery and homicide is significantly higher in Milwaukee than it is in Madison. But the incidence of a rape is significantly higher in Madison than it is in Milwaukee. This kind of analysis of statistics needs to be done and teased out and delved into, and that's the way violence research has to proceed. Even within California, we have significant differences, and they allow you to test out theories. Why should the murder rate in Los Angeles be double that in San Francisco or triple that in San Jose? Well, if you're trying to tie homicide to things like racial distributions or speed of growth or some other demographic variables, there's a way to do it. But what this tends to do is to put paid to many of one's assumptions. Suffice it to say that as far as your neighbors to the south, I come from UCLA, a violent city in a violent state, in a violent country, and the point is, it's going up. Now, if there was this kind of rapid increase in morbidity and mortality rates from any other cause, we would have centers for disease control all over the place. We would have billions in federal funds to get at the bacteria that were causing so much illness and death. But because it's only people damaging and killing people, it is absolutely neglected. The federal government and the several states are doing positively nothing to support investigation along this line. And in fact, anybody who tries it, like myself, is liable to run into more trouble than he ever imagined could attend a scientific enterprise. His character becomes suspect, and he may find himself pilloried in all kinds of ways for even daring to raise the questions about why it is that people are violent toward each other. That's been my experience. This is just another way of looking at the same thing. And I picked the last 5 years, that is 75 to 80, because there's been a suggestion that it's tapering off. When you have over 50% increase in all the major forms of violence in 5 years, you know it's not tapering off. Likewise by communities. I'd like to say another word about suicide. There are many people who think in the back of their minds that if life becomes too weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable, we might our own quietus make, if not with a bare bodkin, then maybe with a bottle of Reds. We think of suicide as a sort of gentle person's way out if life becomes intolerable. The normal person is likely to imagine that under certain circumstances it's a choice he would make. I know people, especially older people, who have a stash they think they might use someday. I know couples, especially older couples, who have a pact. If I have a painful terminal illness, will you help me to shuffle off this mortal coil? Yes, dear, I'll help you. These stashes never get used, except if some children find them and think they're candy. And generally speaking, except for a most rare and usually well-publicized exception, the pacts don't get acted out that way. In fact, suicide is a very violent act. And physicians, who are well equipped to do it quietly and maybe even secretly so that it looks like something else, and certainly painlessly, when they commit suicide, it's just as likely to be violent as anybody else, and we're more at risk than anybody. It's the most suicidal profession. I knew a physician, a distinguished psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, in fact, was president of the New York Psychoanalytic Institute, who, when he chose to die, stabbed himself in the heart with an ice pick in his own living room in the presence of his teenage daughter. That's suicide, and it's a very violent business indeed. And furthermore, keep this in mind, of all the forms of violence around us, this is the one that each of us is most at risk for. Who's most likely to kill you? It's yourself. Same for me, only more so. And who's next most likely? A member of the family, a friend, a neighbor, or a drinking companion. Third, much less likely, a stranger who's in the course of committing a violent crime. Fourth, not negligible, but still much less, a mentally ill person who kills you because of, not because of anything about you, but because of his mental illness. So suicide isn't so gentle, and when you see it, you realize it. Suicides are more like executions than you would expect them to be. Sometimes they're made to look like murders, and they're really suicides. Sometimes a murder and a suicide follow each other in a matter of minutes. Rape is also on the increase, and it's not infrequently, and more, in fact, accompanied by violence of other types, including mayhem and murder. And it isn't only maidens on the village green inflaming the passions of the youth. It could be a 70-year-old woman washing clothes in her own basement, raped and murdered by someone else in the same building. Sometimes the victims are horribly mutilated, and you wonder where all that terrible rage comes from. And sometimes the victims of murder look as though they have been executed by the state, or it's made to look that way. And then, of course, there are the ones that die under conditions that don't get called murder or suicide, but called something else, fatal accidents. Like this one here, but they all have something in common. Of all violent deaths in the United States and Canada, including suicide, homicide, and fatal accidents of all types, at least 50% of them are alcohol related. And keep this in mind too. Although the top three causes of death are heart disease, cancer, and stroke, if you analyze causes of death in terms of years of life lost, by far the number one cause of death is accidents, with fatal violence added in, it shoots it way up, but accidents alone are more than twice as important than the next leading cause of death, if you look at it that way. Are there other ramifications of violence that are of special interest to those in the health-related professions? The woman represented in this picture, just bereaved by an act of violence, say a mugging, is much more likely to fall ill or die herself in the year following this event than if it had not happened. A different series, it varies, but it may be twice or even three times more likely that she will have a fatal illness or die of suicide or of an accident herself. Violence goes beyond the immediate victim. There's a circle of victims. Then there are the witnesses. And I'd like to talk to you now for a while about children. What does it mean for a child to witness violence? To see that there's violence all around him? How does it affect his growth, his development, his personality, his character, and his own behavior later on when he's old enough to do something dangerous? An age that is younger and younger, it seems, as time goes by. We've recently tried to ask ourselves this question, not because we are such ingenious investigators, but because the police shamed us into it by coming to us and saying, isn't anybody in this community interested in what happens to the kids we have to interrogate as witnesses to murders? Well, there are lots of kids are witnesses to murders. In Los Angeles County last year, more than 10% of all murders were committed by children. But we decided to pick a rather limited group to study. We chose children who witnessed the murder of a parent. And in no time at all, it seems, we've already got 20 cases. Of those, half of the murderers were the other parent. And of the remaining, all but one of the remaining murderers were people that the child knew, other members of the family or neighbors, or lovers of the dead parent. Only one was a stranger. Well, needless to say, these children are traumatized far beyond what even the police could see. And they frequently cover it up in such a way that They're extremely well behaved, and nobody realizes that what's happened to them, or that they've been damaged, or that they need help. But a child who's in a violent environment may decide that adults or other people are pretty dangerous objects of attachment and make emotional attachments to inanimate objects instead. Now, such a child as this one might grow up extremely well behaved, obedient, always on time for school, always have her homework done, a little timid, a little shy, a little constricted, and everyone would say this is the best girl in the class. Psychiatrically the least troubled. Such a person could go through life compliant, making no waves, and never fulfill some potentialities of creativity, and never expand to the full potential limits of her personality development out of deep-seated apprehensions instilled because of violence in the environment in childhood. Sometimes children are accidentally injured. That can make it pretty scary when you get hurt and nobody even had you in mind. But of course, sometimes they do have you in mind. And that gets us into one of the most important and instructive aspects of interpersonal violence. That's child abuse, battered children, damaged children, mostly at the hands of their parents or parent surrogates. We've learned a lot about this recently. 3% of all those murders in those rapidly rising curves I showed you are children murdered by their own parents or parent substitutes. We know that mothers are more likely to burn and scald their children, and that fathers are more likely to smash and fracture theirs. But while the mothers have by far the highest body count, if you make corrections for the amount of time that women spend with children compared with men, it turns out even. In other words, children are equally at risk from males or female adults. Just depends who happens to be around. And who are these adults who engage in acts like this? Acts of commission, so devastating as to stagger the imagination of an audience like this one. You might shudder at infanticide, but shudder more at the kind of cruel neglect which would make simple murder seem merciful. And I'm not showing you pictures taken from Auschwitz. This is from California, which, if it were a separate nation, would be, we are told, the seventh most affluent in the world. And what's happening with this phenomenon? Is it just a matter of increased awareness or reporting? Well, in the last 5 years in Los Angeles, there's been no change in reporting methods, and because of cutbacks in funding, there are actually fewer people involved in the work. So any changes in the data are changes in reality, changes in what's really happening to the children out there. And in Los Angeles County, sexual abuse up 234% in 5 years, physical abuse up 193% in 5 years, and it's continuing to go up like that. Now, the adults who are doing this to these children are exemplars of interpersonal violence, because the children, a good many of them, are too young to talk. And most of the victims of child abuse and neglect are below the age of 5. And these parents who commit these seemingly incomprehensible acts of violence against their own children are people from all walks of life who, it turns out, were themselves the victims of violence in childhood. They were battered children. They grew up. They batter their children now. And furthermore, extrapolating from the findings of our battered child studies, it turns out that most of the people who commit the most egregious type of violence out there, the most meaningless, armed robberies and the most gruesome rapes and the most unwarranted mayhem and the most casual murders almost invariably turn out to be people who were beaten, battered, cruelly treated, and criminally neglected in childhood themselves. Now, why is it happening and why is it increasing so fast? One of the explanations that's often given is that it's because of economic reasons. It has to do with poverty. That seems strange. When the United States is such an affluent country, and we compare ourselves with other countries that are far less affluent and find that their rates of violence are much lower than ours. Still, we're in North America. So I decided to take a look at the poorest people in North America. I was looking at them anyway for other reasons. Here's where they live. This is the Sierra Madre Occidental of north central Mexico. It is a vast, bleak, forbidding country with virtually no resources, so no one has tried to exploit it much. And throughout this mountainous range, southern Chihuahua and northern Sinaloa, where you wouldn't think a jackrabbit could live, there are in fact 50,000 Tarahumara Indians, the largest relatively unacculturated group of people left among the North American Aboriginals. This is a Tarahumara metropolis, you might say. That's a joke because there's practically nobody there. They're spread very thin over this country. In the winters, they go down into the deep canyons or barrancas and live in caves because up on the plateaus it gets quite harsh. And then in the spring, they come up the slopes like this mother and child to plateaus. All right, I can follow instructions as well as the next fella. Plateaus like this one. This is a village called Sahawachik, and it's relatively prosperous as Tarahumara villages go. They come out in the springtime, they plant some crops if they can find a patch of soil that'll grow anything. Mostly corn. They live almost completely on corn. They have almost no meat or other protein foods. They have some vegetables. They have some beans, which do have protein. They have some squash. But it's a corn economy. They get around from one place to another on foot, and they're very prodigious hikers. In fact, they don't really hike. They run everywhere they go. They wear a diaper like breech clout, which makes it easy to run, and sandals, and they stick pretty much most of the time to the original folkways and costumes. They'll wear white man's finery, discarded near the railroad sometimes for a dress-up occasion, but most of the time they remain very much the way they were before Columbus landed. A dignified, thoughtful, graceful people with folkways and customs that are similar to the southwestern mountain Indians in many ways, save one. And I'll come to that one in a minute. Just a few other things about Sahawachik. This is the oldest man in the village. He's in his 80s. We don't know exactly how old he was, but it was more than 80. We figured that out. But if he wanted to go and visit an old friend of his in the next village, 20 miles away, at Sisaguichik, he would run the whole way. At a good clip, too. Reminds me of my mother. She's 83 and still shovels her own snow. But I don't think she could run 20 miles. This little girl chase those goats all day long. Now, they don't eat the goats. They keep the goats mainly for the manure that the goats produce to fertilize fields like this one, which isn't exactly rich Middle Western loam. But without the fertilizer, it won't grow much of anything. And the planting is terribly important. In fact, the only time they paint themselves is at the time of the spring planting ceremonies, which the Jesuits, who have lived among them for nearly three centuries, call Easter. Here's the corn crop in the good part of the field that year coming up, and this is the harvest later that same season. They got up to about hip high. You know, real corn is way over your head. But this was considered very good, and that corn has to get them through the whole winter. They make it into breadstuffs and the other meals that the Mexican Indians traditionally use, but they also make it into something else. It's a strong beer called Tesguino. It's a sort of milky color. It packs quite a wallop. These people had alcohol long before the white man came, and were less vulnerable then to the use of distilled spirits as a tool of exploitation or in the bargaining. Not only that, these people never had anything much like beaver skins or something for the whites to get away from them, and so they were pretty well kept out of it. But they do drink Tesguino, and they make it from corn, and they drink it all their lives. Whenever there's a batch made up, everyone comes together, drinks Tesguino, and gets roaring drunk and stays drunk for days till it's all gone, because it doesn't keep. It wouldn't do to waste it. This is the gobernador of Sahuachic. Actually, that's a misnomer of the Spaniards. He's not really a governor or a chieftain. The Indian word for him is Sariami, which literally means staff. It's a wooden staff he carries as a badge of office, and it's the only real office in the village. He is a judge. He's chosen by the other villagers for his fairness of mind to settle disputes. That's the only kind of a person that they need. Otherwise, their folkways handle everything. He's 63 years old at the time of this picture. Still the best wrestler in the village, by the way. And he's just chug-a-lugged a dipper full of Tesguino. He's still got a little on his mouth there. And his judgment was that was very good Tesguino, but not as good as his mother used to make. That's what he said. Come Tesguinada, when everyone comes together to drink Tesguino. It's a big celebration. You dress up in any Western clothes you have. And then there are all kind of competitions. They're very competitive people. They bet on every kind of a contest. This game is called cuatro. It's something like horseshoes, but it's played with a stone thrown a long distance toward a hole. One of the few things the white man had that they liked was the violin. And they're very clever people, very skillful people. They're like the polar Eskimos in that when they were introduced to things like machinery or some kind of Western challenge, they learned it at incredible speed. They make these violins themselves. They carve them out of native woods. Time was 10, 15 years ago, you could buy a fiddle like this back in the Barranca country for equivalent of about 25 cents. Quite a good tone. But they play their own music. They don't play Western music. You don't find transistor radios and that sort of thing out there. It's really too far away. And they don't care for it anyway. They make their own music, which is quite interesting to listen to. And they work the fiddle right into their Aboriginal dances, which is, of course, part of the native animistic religion of the Tarahumara Indian. Here you see a man looks he's about to kick a ball. Actually, that ball is carved out of a local hard wood. It's a little bigger than a croquet ball, and he's practicing for a race. The Tarahumara Indians run kickball races over mountain trails over a mile high with three or four men on a side, or maybe five, distances 50 to 200 miles, each side kicking a ball the whole way. That's a race. Of course, if you're going to have a race like that, there's got to be betting. And the women are just as much in on it as the men. In fact, more so, because it's all by barter system. They don't really have any money. So they'll bet household articles. And here's one of the runners trying to get some women to bet on his side in the race. Everyone turns out for the race. This mother and two children, a typical family group. This little boy now, he's no baby. He's 4 or 5 years old. His father's one of the runners. Look how his mother sort of cuddling him. That kind of behavior is rather unusual among the North American Indians, commonplace with the Tarahumara. Two of my colleagues in this work, I thought there might be some old Oklahoma hands here. The shorter one, Dr. Alfonso Paredes, once one of my students, now he's a professor at UCLA. And the taller chap, Bob Brooks, is an electronics whiz. These two guys were out there with me. They were 16 miles away from where this race that we were sponsoring was being run. We had battery packs on the backs of all the runners because we were interested in their pulmonary and cardiac functions as well as other things. How they can run these long races at these high altitudes for such long distances and endure it on a diet of a few handfuls of corn. This, you know, when you run a race like the type I'm talking about, and they gather first thing in the morning, and then they start betting. That may take till 3 p.m. before all the bets are down. Then they set off running. It's for 50 or 100 miles. They're going to be running all night. How are you going to see the ball? Well, your friends run along with you 10 or 20 miles at a stretch, carrying torches and hollering and hooping and encouraging you on. This lad had been doing that in the race the night before, had fallen down a gully and torn his leg open, and I'm just about there to sew it up. That's really me without my beard. And let me say that as a physician doing cross-cultural studies, I've learned that a little bit of first aid is better than a ticket of admission anywhere you want to go. And the local witch doctors, shamans, curanderos, or whatever you want, are perfectly happy to have your help. Little Western medicine. This chap dropped out of this race after only 50 miles. He couldn't get used to the battery pack. However, this is the winner. He finished up. See, his feet are very dusty. 3 years old and still the best runner. But it was the children I really meant to tell you about all the time. The Tarahumara children are very lovable children. They are attractive. They are a little shy at first with strangers, but they quickly warm up to you. They're affectionate. They're mischievous. They have a wonderful spirit. They're extremely well behaved and obedient. You'll fall in love with them at sight, and the more you're around them, the more it grows. They'll break your heart. And I think that's enough of the slides. Time is coming to an end, and I have to come to the point. What's the point? These people are on the brink of starvation all the time. The death rate among their children is very high, mostly from malnutrition and the complications of malnutrition, infection mostly. So that by the age of 6 or 7, maybe 70% of the children will have died. This means that the survival rate per family is maybe 2 children. You have 0 population growth in the Sierra Madre Occidental. It's protein deficiency, mostly. If they make it to maybe age 8, the immune system has matured enough so they'll live to a ripe old age, unless the crops are very bad. These people are poor in a way that almost nobody else in North America knows about anymore. But in that entire vast region, where there are only the Tarahumar Indians living, there are no jails, no prisons, no police, no soldiers, there's no crime, no delinquency, no violence of any kind. These people drink alcohol all their lives, all of them, from adolescence to death. They get drunk regularly. And I have never seen or heard of a case of alcoholism, as we understand it, among the mountain Tarahumara people. And they don't become violent when they're drunk. The suicide rate among the North American Indians is the highest of any group. Ethnically, the whites have a higher suicide rate than the blacks by far. But the American Indians have the highest of all. Nobody has ever heard of a suicide among the Tarahumara. And as I say, there are Jesuits who've been living among them for 300 years, and they are very good reporters, and they know a lot about these Indians. Rape and other kinds of sex crimes, absolutely unknown. There's been one homicide in 50 years that anybody ever heard of, and that was an accident. Strictly an accident. Certainly wasn't a murder. So here you have, they don't even steal. They don't steal from each other. They don't steal from strangers. And among the American Indians of the Southwest, stealing from a stranger was considered a very honorable act. If a Navajo could steal a horse from an Arapaho, he would be able to tell his grandchildren about that and boast about it. If white people wandered into the Tarahumara country thinking that they were going to be captured and killed or tortured by Apaches who border the Tarahumara on the north, or Yaqui who bordered them on the east and who would have butchered them in a minute, the Tarahumara would take care of them, share what little they had with them, and help them find their way out. The early accounts of such things were seemed almost miraculous. Now, what is there about these people that makes them this way? I'll tell you what I think it is. They are cultural sports, freaks, accidents of nature. Something happened more than 2,000 years ago. That's how long we know for sure they've been living there. In the way they raise their children and in their attitudes toward child rearing. Tarahumara Indians never punish a child for anything, ever. And furthermore, they don't threaten to and can't imagine doing it. Or for an adult to inflict pain or threaten to upon a child is unthinkable. Or to withhold something from a child that the child might need, like sending him to bed without his supper. The concept of punishment is absent from their culture. It's absent. And it isn't just toward children, it's toward anybody. You don't punish anybody for anything. You don't teach people how to differentiate right from wrong. You don't teach people how to behave or how not to misbehave by pain. Now, we do that, and we take it for granted. It's been taught us. It's come down to us through the teachings of the great Western religions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam. A deity, a punitive deity, who will punish transgressors, and his agents punish people. And all the laws and all the cultural structures and all the psychiatric theories about normal personality development take for granted the fact that normal people must have experienced punishment. Because if you never experienced punishment, how would you learn to feel guilt? We think that it's guilt That is the gyroscope for right and wrong. We think it's guilt that keeps us on the beaten track, and that without that guilt, well, we would be psychopaths. We would lack a superego, a conscience. The still small voice is really the voice of guilt. Even if no man knows that you have transgressed, somebody knows. And even if there's nobody up there, you know, you'll punish yourself one way or another. You'll feel guilt, you'll suffer. Now the Tarahumara don't believe anything like that. If a child of the Tarahumara does something wrong, it's not very common because they're with the adults most of the time, and their adults are very affectionate to the children, and the children imitate adults. The Tarahumara need their children. Their children help with the work. They're not pets. They're participants in the life of the family. They're important. They're respected. And they're expected to help. And the girls help their mothers. The boys help their fathers. And they know what to do. But if they do something wrong, the adults laugh at them. And the child will hang his head in shame. Shame, I submit to you, is a much more powerful extinguisher of unwanted behaviors than is guilt. This is a pure shame culture. Guilt doesn't enter into it. Guilt is the anticipation of punishment. Shame represents a kind of disgrace. It's biologically different. It's physically different, the two experiences. Guilt is like the conditional form of the pain response. Pale, dry mouth, dilated pupils, heart beating fast. Shame starts with a flush, just the opposite. And you can even see one of these copper-toned little kids blush with shame if he makes a mistake like I saw one kid make, playing tag with his little brother, tagged him too hard, the little brother fell down and he let out a yelp. All the adults looked at the older boy and they started laughing at him, point their finger at him. Did you ever see anything so ridiculous? A big boy hurting a little one? And he just hung his head. And you knew he wouldn't do that again. Guilt isn't necessary, apparently. And everything we've been taught was wrong. At least it's wrong as far as something inherent about human nature is concerned, because these are human beings. And as Father Yaguno, the head of the Jesuit mission, said to me once, in 300 years, these people have taught us more about Christianity than we have taught them. And they didn't even know what to call it. It was just their way. It is something that we have to understand, because we live in a time where we're pouring oil on the fire of violence. The notion of how to deal with it is we need to become more punitive. The more violence there is, the more punishment there has to be. The more severe the sentences. Bring back the death penalty. Beat your children more. A recent vice president of the United States, Mr. Spiro Agnew, once spelled it out in a national broadcast. He said, the reason we're having such an increase in delinquency is that we don't know how to raise our children anymore. When I was a boy, he said, my father believed in the old dictum to spare the rod and spoil the child. The implication was that's how he grew up so honest. But he said, what's destroying this nation and undermining our moral fiber is this permissiveness. Permissiveness being a euphemism for kindness. And you know who it turned out that he named in his speech to blame for all the crime and the delinquency and the violence? Dr. Benjamin Spock, who wrote a book saying you don't have to beat the hell out of your child to raise him successfully. Now here we have two cultures, one in which we got lots of punishment, one in which we beat the hell out of children and we are cruel to them and we neglect them and we damage them in all sorts of ways, and then the ones who survive grow up, and for reasons that we psychiatrists understand but that I won't take the time to explain now, identification with the aggressor and all that, such people are more likely to commit acts of violence toward their own children or toward strangers or toward anybody because of what they have experienced themselves. And these children, who've known nothing but kindness and care from adults, even though everyone is poor and nature is always there, they're the kindliest people you'll ever find. The children of violence grow up violent. The children of kindness grow up kind. And believe me, there's a lesson in there for all of us. Thank you very much for your patience.
Thank you very much. Dr. West will answer questions, as our usual practice.
I'd be happy to answer questions if there's anybody who's...
Would you say that the Japanese who look after the children in a similar manner and don't punish them until they get to a certain age, and then they really expect in common is a sort of an offshoot or plain source of
the question is how would I compare with these people, the Japanese, who are very permissive with their children, are very non-punitive up to a certain age, and then the tradition of Bushido perhaps makes itself felt. Well, I think that's the key. And it explains, it's been studied a good deal, it explains some of the special things about the Japanese character, or if that's too presumptuous, let's say the Japanese data. Strong propensity for collective violence. Considerable inhibition against interpersonal violence of certain types, although you find it, with a very high suicide rate and a very low homicide rate in the country. I guess my answer would be, if you're going to be kind to your children, keep it up. Don't stop at age 5. The question here is, why did the suicide rate peak in Australia and then come down again? The correct answer is, I don't know. But I'll tell you what I suspect, although this suspicion is not one of the explanations I received down there. The medical profession said they thought it had something to do with the laws governing the prescription of sedatives, which had been relaxed and then were tightened up again. Well, it's true that they were relaxed during that period. But when I attempted to find out whether the increase in suicides was due to overdoses of those sedatives, it turned out that they hadn't made that much difference. No, I think it had to do with who the people were that were imported to Australia as workers from other parts of Asia in large numbers during that period of time, and what their circumstances were. Many of them were from cultures where suicide was not rare, and they came to work, but their families didn't, and they were alone, and they drank a lot, and many of them then committed suicide. They were migrant workers. There's a somewhat similar phenomenon in Alaska since the pipeline. The homicide and suicide rates peaked and fell off just in the last few years, since all the construction on the pipeline stopped and a lot of those people departed. This may be the explanation, but I haven't yet got the data to support that, because it means then digging out the ethnic backgrounds of all the people who committed suicide in Australia at that time, and I haven't found the resources to dig it out. Nobody seems to be particularly interested in digging it out. But that's the kind of work that has to be done before you could make that assumption anything more than just an educated guess. Yes, sir.
The gun lobby of the United States has been responsible for saying, in effect, that guns don't kill people, people kill people. And I was interested in whether or not this lobby has been responsible for holding back on the granting of funds for the kind of research you're interested in.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised, but I doubt it. They didn't need to. There's more to the resistance to research on violence than that. I think there is an apprehension that the coin that says violence on the front says something like control on the back. There's a fear that if people like me learn that violence is some kind of a sickness, or if we learned enough to be able to prevent people from being violent, we would have learned something that the government would be able to use to suppress political dissent. We would find mysterious drugs that would make people more tranquil and less likely to be violent or aggressive, for example. That was one of the charges that was levied, and still is levied periodically at me, that I'm really a CIA agent, and that I'm interested in using mysterious chemicals and drugs so that the government can control people and prevent political dissent. Well, this isn't too realistic in terms of what you might call the historical facts. Mussolini found out that castor oil worked very well. If the government has the power to give people some substance, you force a pint of castor oil down them two or three times under duress, and the subsequent diarrhea weakens them so badly that they don't make any trouble anymore. And furthermore, the chemical that produces the most sense of, let's say that dissolves aggressiveness the most, which is cannabis, is the very one that the government seems to be trying the hardest to keep the people from using, which is marijuana and its derivatives. It isn't to say that it's good for you. It's not. It's a dangerous drug, and I urge people not to use it. But the fact is there are plenty of dangerous drugs that produce tranquility, and the opiates are the best examples. If the government really wanted to see people tranquil, they would just make it to provide free opium for whoever wanted it. But that isn't what it's all about. It's the fear of being controlled that's important, and that's why any law that's called gun control is very unlikely to get passed. But even if it is passed, I wouldn't bank too much on it making much of a difference. I'm in favor of the registration of handguns, mainly because I think it helps police in their work and makes it more likely that you can trace such a weapon and perhaps place the blame on the correct perpetrator. But New York has had a very stringent gun control law for 40 years, the Sullivan Act, which makes it a felony to possess a pistol in New York. It's been there all the time. I was in New York in 1951 when somebody gave me a pistol as a souvenir, a famous explorer that I had treated, and he said, "Take this, I had it with me in the jungles." I thought, gee, I better register this. I took it to the police station, which was two blocks from the hospital, and they were going to arrest me because how could I have gotten there carrying this gun without having broken the law? Nevertheless, with a law like that, like the Sullivan Act, last year in New York City, 586 people were shot to death with pistols, and in Tokyo, which is a larger city and which has no such law, there were three. Somebody said Tokyo wasn't next door to New Jersey. But the answer is, I don't think you even need to go to New Jersey to get a handgun. And the answer is that the gun control laws that are being offered all have to do with possession. But that's not where the problem comes. It comes with manufacture and sale. If you control that or prevent that or prohibit that, then you might see a decrease in the widespread ownership of handguns. But that's not about to happen. So there is one firearm, mostly handguns, for every man, woman, and child in the United States. Yes, ma'am.
Would you say that violence as portrayed on television has had any influence in the increase of violence in society?
The question is, what role has violence on television had with relationship to the increase of violence in society? We have some information about this, although I certainly can't give you the final answer. It's not the whole story, that's certainly obvious. Japan has more violence, significantly more violence in their television than we do. They love the violent programs. And yet their homicide rates have been relatively unaffected, even though the violence on the television is accepted and rampant. Studies in the U.S. show that there are two general things that can be said about it. First is that the most violent programs have the least effect on the children, and they are the cartoons. The reason is that the children know that the cartoons are cartoons. The cartoons don't bother them, even though the rabbit is always blowing up the fox, and the next minute the fox is back again. Or the roadrunner is blowing up the coyote. I guess that's the way it is. But dramatized programs are a little more troublesome to children. And you should understand that the greatest effect of television violence on children is not to make them violent, but to make them frightened and give them nightmares and phobias and the creeps. But the most threatening, frightening, troublesome, and emotionally disturbing type of violence on television is in the news. The children know that this is real, and that frightens them. Now, if you look at it in another way, the question is the dramatization of violence as something to imitate. It turns out that most children are relatively unaffected by the representation of violence in dramatized form. Doesn't affect their subsequent behavior one way or another. There's a group of children who, having seen dramatized violence, are less likely to act out a violent solution to a problem themselves. It's as though there's a vicarious discharge of their own violent impulses through the drama, and they're relieved thereby. And then there's another group of children who are mostly disturbed children to begin with, which isn't to eliminate much because there are a great many troubled children for some of the reasons I've been mentioning. And among these children, there are a fair number who are more likely to seek a violent solution following the representation of it in a dramatized program. Having said all that, I'll tell you that I believe there's far too much violence in television, and it's mostly because it's cheap to produce. You can have excellent programming without showing all this kind of violence, but it takes more craft. It takes better writing and better acting and better directing and better production values and all the rest to make it interesting and entertaining. Or if you have people hurting each other, it attracts attention enough so then you can sell Tylenol during the commercials. Yes, sir.
Does the fact that the territory of the Indians is not particularly desirable to the neighbors, does this have any bearing on their quiet manner?
The question is, does the fact that the Tarahumara live in such unprepossessing surroundings relate to the fact that they are so peaceful? Let me say that the Tarahumara, while they're peaceful, have had their wars. If they are, they were traditional enemies of the Apache, who biologically are just like them, but culturally so very different. The Apache is very warlike, very aggressive, and much more likely to raid. And they raided the Tarahumara country from time to time, seeking things that really weren't there. The Tarahumara would fight back, and they're good fighters. They're competitive, vigorous, assertive people. It's just that they don't hurt each other. They don't hurt people for no reason. They'll if there's a deer, they'll run him down. One Tarahumara Indian can run down a deer. They just keep chasing. They can't catch him right away, but they just keep running after him, and eventually the deer will get so fatigued he can't continue. Then the Indian will run right up to him and cut his throat and dress him and butcher him and put him on his shoulders and run back. And the Tarahumara did go north for reasons of their own, one of which is kind of interesting if for those of you who like folk medicine. The Tarahumara have been known to use peyote. Peyote contains mescaline, and it's used in what's called the Native American church. It was used by many of the Plains Indians to produce religious visions, and they still do. In the United States, they're allowed, if they belong to the Native American church, to chew the peyote buttons and have mescaline hallucinosis as part of a religious ceremony. The Tarahumara would send runners from their mountains all the way up to the Big Bend country of the Rio Grande River to pick the peyote buttons and bring them back to the medicine man. But they didn't use them in their religious ceremonies in the same way that the Navajo and the others did. Instead, if the medicine man had a patient with a puzzling illness, he, the medicine man, would take the mescaline, give him a vision of what to do for the patient. That's modern medicine, I guess. Yes, sir. Do the Tarahumara have dogs? Yes, they do. And as far as I can make out, they're relatively kind of the dogs, too, which again is not traditional among the North American Indians, who kept dogs at least partly to have something to eat when times got very bad. The Tarahumara don't eat their dogs. Yes, ma'am. I think the question is whether pornography is involved in the increase in sex crimes, including incest. Well, there was a scientific commission appointed by the President of the United States several years ago to study the pornography question. And some very distinguished people served on it. And they reviewed all that there was possible to review and came to the conclusion that that while pornography may be disgusting and, or even worse, boring in the extreme, that it was not necessarily pathogenic of crime or violence. They did some cross-cultural studies. For example, they looked at the lowest crime rate practically in Europe in the country that had the most freewheeling pornography, namely Denmark. It's true that people with certain kinds of psychiatric disorders and sexual disturbances will use pornography of different kinds, including pornographic representations of children. It doesn't seem to have any direct bearing. and with particular reference to incest, which is a type of child molestation far more common than we used to think. There's no evidence at all to suppose that pornography has driven the incestuous parent to it. And incidentally, while we might decide that little Annie Fanny is pornographic or something in Hustler, in Atascadero State Hospital, which is the institution in California for the sexually disturbed offenders, some of the most dangerous people there were quite unmoved by what we ordinarily consider pornographic, and what was considered among them to be a really pornographic picture was an advertisement for suntan oil that showed a little child on the beach with his bathing suit drooping a little bit and part of his tuchus showing. That was considered pornographic by these hardened sex offenders. And no one else would even consider that pornographic. It's a little bit like the sex offender who's being examined by the psychiatrist who decides to study him with the Rorschach test, and he shows him the first ink blot, and the man says, that looks like a male sex organ. And he shows him the second ink blot, and he says, that looks like a female sex organ. He shows him the third ink blot, and the chap says, that looks like two people having sex. And so with every card, it's like that, and with a sexual response, and the doctor gets all through, and he turns to the man, and he says, I'll tell you what's wrong with you, mister. You're obsessed with sex. And the man says, what do you mean? It's not my problem. You're the one showing the dirty picture.
I'll now call on Dr. Peter Sudfeld to express the thanks of the meeting.
I think those of you who have been coming to the Institute for any length of time, even as short as since last week, know that we have a tradition. And the tradition is that the talks we get tend to be intellectually really hot or artistically really hot, but emotionally very cool. I think this was an exception. And the impact that having a talk that is both intellectually and emotionally hot, I think, was reflected by the questions and the attention that the speaker received. I think we should thank him for that. I think we should also thank him for cooling it down before the end, because if he had left us at the high state of discomfort and distress that I think we all reached at one point during his talk, this would be a very uncomfortable assemblage leaving tonight.